Fresh Air. It's 4 minutes to 4 o'clock, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. And with me is television journalist Linda Ellerbee. Last week, on her TGIF feature on the Today Show, she said goodbye to her colleague and former co-anchor Lori Dobbins, who had just left NBC. This morning, she said goodbye to NBC, where she's worked since 1975. Her contract expired this week, and she was unable to work out mutually acceptable terms for renewal. Hopefully we'll still get to see her on TV. There are rumors of offers from other networks. As the co-anchor of NBC Overnight and Weekend, Linda Ellerbee managed to break a lot of rules and win the highest praise for it from media critics and viewers. The Columbia University DuPont Broadcasting Award cited Overnight as possibly the best-written and most intelligent news program ever. The word intelligent gets back to one of the rules that she broke. She'd been frequently advised to cover stories as if viewers had never heard of Lebanon or whatever country the story was about. But she says she always assumed a degree of intelligence and curiosity of her viewers. One newspaper critic described her as one of the least sexy anchors on TV, which gets to another rule she broke. She didn't dress to be a sex pot or to be a beauty queen. She didn't even dress for success. She dressed casually, wore glasses, and didn't lacquer down her hair. NBC Overnight was a news magazine that aired at 1:30 each morning for 17 months, beginning in July of 1982. The show presented lengthier, more in-depth versions of reports that aired during the day in the States and on overseas networks. Overnight ran CBC and BBC footage of the African famine before NBC News did. The end of Overnight was reserved as a time for essays written and read by the anchors. Linda Ellerbee has written a new book. It's called And So It Goes, Adventures in Television, and it's published by Putnam. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's so nice to have someone be so factually accurate.
Oh.
But that is more accurate than my NBC biography was.
I'm glad it was accurate. Well, you just resigned. I was surprised to see this morning you leaving NBC. What were the reasons for your leaving?
Just what you said. We couldn't get together on a contract. I had been there 11 years, and for 10 of those years, NBC was number three in the ratings. And every time my contract came up, I had offers from other networks, and I didn't go. In the 11th year, we were number one, and I was asked to take a 40% pay cut. And it seemed inappropriate. It seemed unfair is what it seemed. It just seemed plain unfair. And I couldn't do it. I don't blame them. The news division lost $70 million last year. So they have their problems. They had to do what they had to do, and I had to do what I had to do.
Did you interpret the 40% pay cut as an invitation to leave?
No, I that's a terrible thing to say, but I'm too vain to. I really didn't. And in fact, they made it very plain to me that they didn't want me to leave, but they just simply. In fact, you know, GE is coming in to take over NBC, and I think there's a certain amount of pre-censorship, in a way, corporate heart palpitating going on. We have to straighten this whole thing out before GE comes in. We have to show them what a money-minded corporation we are.
Do you know what your next step will be?
No. My next step, in the next few weeks, I'm going to be working on some articles for magazines that I agreed to write, one for Sports Illustrated and one for Ms. and one for TV Guide, entitled What I Would Do If I Ran a Network News Division. And I told them, I said, that's a short article. I'd quit. And they said, no, but what would you do on the way out the door? So I said, well, all right, I'll do that. It's basically a humorous piece.
Do you feel like you were in any way made an example of at NBC? For instance, if you break some of the rules and are too independent-minded, here's what's going to happen to you. Eventually, you're going to ask to be taking quite a pay cut.
No, I don't think it's that way. I got along there at NBC. I mean, I get continually asked in various forms, the question comes off as, well, how is it you're so odd and survive? And the fact is, it says an awful lot of good things about NBC that almost everything that I have said in this book, I have been allowed to say on the air, on NBC's air. And it would be incorrect on my part for me to sit here and say, oh, no, my big problem was that I was odd. I mean, that may have been their big problem, but it wasn't mine, and it wasn't even their big problem. Might have been a small one, but their big problem was money.
Leaving NBC has...
It hurts. I mean, it's a strange day. It's been a very strange time. I was asked this morning by a reporter right after I came off the air and You will understand, because it was a television reporter. The first thing I was asked was, how do you feel about this? Not even what did I think about it, but how do you feel? And I laughed and we talked. And then I was asked, well, where would you like to be working if you had your choice? And I thought of it and I said, well, until today, the answer was NBC News. It feels strange. You get, after that long, you know, it's not a Peacock. It's not 30 Rockefeller Plaza. It's not a corporation. It's the people you work with for so many years. I will miss them. And I'm feeling that separation very, very keenly today.
Do you feel personally rejected at all? Or?
Sure, I do. Of course. You know, on the stressometer, this is one of the big ones. Breaking off with a job that you've had for this long, and happily, I've had a good time there. NBC's been good to me. I had a good ride for almost 11 years. Of course I feel rejected. I can be smart enough to step back and say, well, I understand all these reasons. You know, and then the two-year-old inside me says, of course I understand them, and now I want to pull the covers over my head and turn the electric blanket up to 9 and kick my feet.
Is this going to change you at all in terms of, like, your behavior on TV?
No.
Are you going to be more cautious or try
not
to be more conventional?
No, not at all. I mean, if that were going to happen, I would have done that and stayed there, right?
Right. My guest is Linda Ellerbe, who left NBC this morning. Linda Ellerbe has written a new book. It's called And So It Goes, Adventures in Television. Let's talk about some of the rules you gladly broke on programs like Weekend and Overnight. One of the things you've always tried to do is write your own copy. Why is that such a big deal?
Well, it shouldn't be such a big deal. I mean, I have never understood why, you know, you see stories in the paper where they're paying ex-anchorman or anchorwoman $400 million a year. And then they're allowing what that person says to be written by some 24-year-old in an entry-level job. And I don't understand why anchors allow that to happen. I can't imagine not writing what I say. I'm not an actress. I can't read words. I can't read a script that I didn't write.
The style that you've developed for your journalistic copy on television is more personal, more ironic than the standard copy. What kind of balance do you like to keep between just presenting the facts and injecting more flavor in it?
Well, you have to keep a careful balance. You do. But the audience is intelligent enough to separate fact from thought without you having to put a large flashing neon graphic in front of you saying, commentary, here comes commentary. And you know, that's the dreadful trap we've gotten into in television, that if you're thinking, then it's supposed to be commentary. My pal Lloyd Dobbins, who has just left television to go to North Carolina, he's going to write fiction, he says, because after so many years of writing facts, he wants to write truth.
What can you think of an example of a story that you wrote the copy for that really is for you a perfect example of the balance that you like to keep between adding, you know, personal thoughts to a story and keeping it, you know,
boy,
objective and everything?
I'm always terrible when you ask for examples, but I mean, most White House news conferences strike me that way. If the president comes out and he says, as he did last summer, and he went on national television and he said that South Africa had eliminated segregation as we knew it in this country. And both you and I know that's not so. I think a reporter has an obligation to stand up and say the emperor is wearing no clothes. That's not so. The man is misinformed. And someone is going to write you and say, well, but that's your opinion. When we did Overnight, I would constantly get letters that said, why do you hate President Reagan? Well, I didn't hate President Reagan. I didn't have a show when Carter was president. I think we have an obligation to question authority. I don't think that the only way to look at a politician is down, but I think sideways makes sense. It's important for a reporter to put that critical distance between herself and those she covers, the same as it's important for the audience to put that same critical distance between his or herself, someone in the audience, and me. They should not take everything I say at face value. I mean, they're quite capable of looking at it and saying, well, look, this is what she said and this is what she thinks. And what we ought to be in the business of is raising questions and not simplifying everything into answers, because very often there is more than one answer.
Was there a story that you wrote where you thought, in retrospect, that you'd gone too far?
I'm sure there is. Not one doesn't come to mind at the moment. If you have one in mind, remind me of it.
No, I didn't really.
I don't know a reporter who hasn't at some time gone too far, but I will tell you there are just as many, or probably a lot more, that I feel that I didn't go far enough.
What would you have liked to say that you didn't? Can you think of something?
I have a problem with very often we've gotten into this situation of balance to the extent that if someone goes on the air and says, racism is wrong, we're supposed to put someone on the air who says racism is right. And I simply don't believe in that. I mean, there are things that are right and wrong. Last February, my daughter, who goes to college in Massachusetts, called me and asked me to come to Philadelphia and march in an anti-racist riot. March with her. And I said, well, I really don't think that's appropriate for me as a reporter. And I don't think that NBC would think that's a good idea. And she said, but Mother, the point of the march is simply anti-racism. Are you saying that NBC would take the opposite stand? And, you know, she raised a good question. And I came here and marched with her.
You did?
Yeah, I did.
One of the things you didn't want to do on Overnight was to banter back and forth.
No.
With your co-anchor.
I hate that.
What do you have against that?
You know, when you watch people on television, on the news, and they're wasting your time talking about their crabgrass with each other. First of all, they're on television. They ought to be talking to the viewer. And secondly, most of that stuff is manufactured, and it's silly. I mean, it's like when they tell each other the news. Well, John, here I have a story about something that happened in the South Bronx today. Really, Mary? Well, the president said today. It's as if, are we to believe that they've not read these scripts before, much less written them? That all of these stories, it's like when they react to the news, you'll see them watch a story on the air and go, oh. You know, when it comes out, there's a little cute expression or a sad expression. Is it the first time they've seen the story? I mean, I used to see, my habit is to watch the stories before I write the lead in. So that anytime you're doing that little acting the news, it is just that. And a fool would pick that up. No, we never talked to each other on the air. And that was funny. I never said my name on the air. And the whole time Overnight was on the air. And what was curious was that newspaper reporters would write about the wonderful chemistry that Lloyd and I have with each other, or that Bill and I have with each other, and how extraordinary a thing, because we were not talking to each other. And what they really meant was chemistry, if you want to use that word, with the audience. And they were mistaking it for something else.
One of the times that co-anchors banter back and forth, as if there's 30 seconds to go before the commercial and there's this time to fill, then you have to ad-lib. Well, have you seen a lot of like mistakes happen that way, a lot of terrible gaps in the ad-libbing?
I mean, that's another reason I don't want to ad-lib. I'm not a stand-up comedian. I'm a writer. I just really don't have any desire to do that. Which I suppose is why I'll probably never be a weather person.
Did you feel like you had a psychological advantage working on Overnight, knowing that the TV executives were home sleeping?
Yes, we did. But the real advantage was not that they were home sleeping, because they all had VCR machines. The real advantage was that because the show was not important to them, and it was put on the air basically because Ted Turner began to sell his 24-hour news service to the network affiliates. And the network took the attitude that if the affiliates wanted news at that time of night, they would give it to them, by God. So that's why Overnight and Night Watch and The Last Word at ABC were put on the air. And it wasn't supposed to have anything to do with ratings. That's what gave us a wonderful freedom. It was almost like the old days of television before John Kennedy was assassinated, when news was a public service throwaway. And then when Kennedy was killed, and we all sat down in front of our television sets for a national catharsis or national wake. And when it was ended, we did not get up and go to our separate tables. The habit was established. And news began to make money. And the minute it began to make money, it began to be tinkered with. And the same thing happened with late night television. As long as we were there simply to frighten away the big bad Ted Turner, we had a lot of freedom. And when it was discovered that Turner was frightened away, then they wanted to make money, and it changed everything.
So suddenly you had to start following the ratings books and...
Well, no, we didn't. I mean, that was the whole point of it. We didn't start doing that, and and then one day we found ourselves off the air.
So if you had, like, cleaned up your act and blah, 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 and followed the ratings and boosted them, you don't think that would happen?
I don't know. I mean, I thought we had the cleanest act in town. I'm more proud of that program than anything I've ever worked on. I would like to see most early newscasts clean up their act.
What would you
like to
see?
But no, I mean, I was not willing, even to keep it on the air, I was not willing to ask Lloyd Dobbins about his crabgrass.
My guest is Linda Ellerbe, and she's, by the way, written a new book, which is titled And So It Goes. Your image on TV has really been different from the image of most women on television because you're not dressing to be sexy. You're not dressing for success either. Did you have to fight for the ability to do that? Was there a period where, before you had established your journalistic credentials, when you had to give in to the consultants and to the executives who wanted women to look just so?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there was a time that I would wear my hair slicked back or pulled up, and very often my lip gloss would match my shoes. And, I mean, there was a time when I worked on Weekend when no reporter at NBC had ever been able to persuade the network to buy their clothes for them, and a number of them had tried. And the network bought clothes for Lloyd Dobbins and me. In fact, it insisted on buying our clothes, and it insisted on having someone else pick them out, and then it insisted on keeping them at the network because it was afraid that Lloyd and I would show up with wearing various parts of all our new clothes all at once. And they were probably right. They were very nice clothes. You could do anything in them except work. But the major fights all along were not the clothes. The major fights were the words. There's a story that's not in the book. One of the first stories I ever covered in Washington for NBC News was the ceremony to hang the official portrait in the Great Hall of Justice of Richard Kleindienst, the only Attorney General of the United States ever indicted on felony charges. And the lead to my story was it was a ceremony of pomp in unusual circumstances. Richard Kleindienst, comma, blah, blah, blah. And the man who was producing for Nightly News looked at it and struck the first line. So it began, Richard Kleindienst, comma, Attorney General, former Attorney General. And it was... And I knew at the time it was just because I was new and I was not trusted. Years later, that same man produced Overnight. And one night there was a story, and I forget what it was, but the lead applied, and I sat down and I typed, it was a ceremony of pomp in unusual circumstances. And I went on with the story, and I handed him my copy, and he looked at it, and he said, good lead, and passed it on. And then I told him.
What did he say?
He laughed. He even recognizes that it is a problem at the network. You get there. And, I mean, I was hired years ago at NBC News because, they said, we're tired of gray jello and we want some interesting writing. And the minute I got there, I had to spend a very long time proving that I could write just as dull as anybody else before I was allowed to write anything else. And what happens at networks in that situation, more often than not, is that the correspondent will begin a dreadful self-censorship. And they will start themselves changing their words into what they know will get by the committee system when they ought to fight it every single day.
Was there a breakthrough moment for you where you felt like, okay, now I've established myself in my own style and I can continue doing that?
Well, I think probably, no, there was no one breakthrough, although after I went to work on Weekend, it was pretty much accepted. I suppose, I mean, those sort of things, it's very funny. People who run network news divisions, and this is not just NBC, and it's probably not just network news divisions, are as influenced by what is written about them as they are by their own hearts and minds. And it was probably not until the press began to write about me as being different, as having a style, and as it not being a bad thing, that they were able to say, oh, well, she's weird and she's strange, but maybe it's not so bad.
And that helped you dress the way you wanted to also?
Yeah, well, the dress, by that time, I had just given up the pretense of I'd thrown out the lip gloss. The last time I put on lip gloss was, and this is too horrible to say, when I had the picture made for the cover of that book. I had just given up on that because, I mean, you know, they say, oh, well, you want to play with the big boys? Fine, you can go to Washington, you can cover the Congress, and you too can chase a senator down the halls, but you must do it wearing high heels and a little tight skirt.
I've always wondered how women
I
could
fall
wear
over.
High
I'm
heels
clumsy.
And chase after
Nonsense.
Somebody.
Listen, Connie Chung and I once had a conversation about our different ways of covering political conventions, which are, in fact, physically the same way. Connie Chung wears pointy-toed high heel shoes to get through a crowd. They're very effective. My problem is I trip over them. I wear pointy-toed cowboy boots to get through a crowd. It is the same method, just turned inside out.
Well, when you were covering the House, you said that there wasn't a dress code for women because they hadn't thought
That's
of women
right.
being there.
That's right. I wore blue jeans every day, and many of the men would get mad at me because they had to wear coats and ties. And as you say, it was just because there was no dress code for women, because when they wrote dress codes, it never, ever occurred to them that a woman would be covering the Congress.
So what but, about you know, on TV,
just,
though?
Just you had one other thing about the way I look on television that I think is important. I may not look like all the women you see on television, but I look like an awful lot of the audience.
That's I mean, that's very, because, I mean, I think people look at you and say, oh, that's my friend. You know, I mean, that's yeah. a real person. That's not a person who just lives in the world of TV. Do you know
yeah.
what I mean?
Listen, there is television and there is the real world. And the minute you start to confuse the two, you're in trouble. You can get another job. You can't get another family.
I've always thought that there's this impression that, you know how children can be very cruel and they'll just pick on somebody's defect and tell them about it to their face and talk to other people about it behind their backs. I think people in television assume that all viewers are like that. And
oh, yeah.
that they just love to just pick on little defects of the people who
yeah,
are on
you
TV.
You get some people who write in and say, I just hate your hair. Or a man who used to write me and tell me that because I wore glasses, I had eyes that looked like two peas in the middle of hula hoops. And, you know, if you let that get to you, you can. But the fact is, you get far more mail if you're paying more attention to your writing than you are your dress. You're going to get the kind of mail that keeps you going, really keeps you going. I got a letter from a 16-year-old girl this week that almost made up for leaving NBC News.
What did it say?
She wrote and she said that she wanted to be a newscaster when she grew up, and that she had been watching me for years, and that she had had her 16th birthday party last week, and it was a costume party, and that she had gone as me, and that she had dressed down for the occasion, and that she had bought my book, and she had bought it with her babysitting money, and she wanted me to know she had paid full price because she bought it before it was a bestseller and therefore discounted, and that when she became a newscaster, she would try very hard not to be a Twinkie.
You have a word for women who...
Oh, it's not just women.
Not just women. No. For women and men who look and act a certain way on television, you call Twinkie. Describe what that is.
Well, it almost doesn't need description. And I didn't invent the word. I mean, I've heard the word around in the business. I just wrote it down. You know, but a Twinkie is someone who acts the news or models the news or someone you're not certain has read the news, much less written it. You know, a Twinkie, the line I've used before is a Twinkie who's someone who may well have blow-dried their brains right along with their hair. And when I first came to work in New York, I moved up there to work for Weekend. And Weekend had a reputation as a writer's program, so I thought I was really hot stuff. I must be a hell of a writer. And I met my next-door neighbor, and she asked what I did, and I spent 20 minutes telling her what I did. And when I was done, she said, oh, you mean you're an anchor woman, dear. How nice. You must meet my tenant. You would have so much in common. And I said, oh, really? Well, what does your tenant do? She said, well, right now she's cutting hair. And I thought to myself, this woman hasn't heard a word I've said. I had nothing against barbers, but I was into journalism. I felt I was very self-important at the time. And I told her, I really didn't think the woman and I would have that much in common. I was making little journalism movies. And she said, oh, well, okay. And I never met the tenant. And about a year later, my children and I were at the movies, and there was a real commotion in my part of the theater when the credits rolled, because after the word editor was the name of the tenant, and the name of the movie was Hair. She was cutting hair. She was the editor of Hair, and I never felt more Twinkie in my whole life, lip gloss or no.
Do you think that television has to be that way with the Twinkies and with the emphasis on
image?
No,
I don't. Absolutely not. I mean, that is part and parcel of the major flaw of television news, which is that most of us who do it think we are so much smarter than people who watch it, simply because we're doing it and they're watching it. I mean, that's the Plummer in Albuquerque theory.
My guest is Linda Ellerbe, and she's written a new book titled And So It Goes, Adventures in Television. When you were at Overnight, I think two of the producers were women, and the show was consequently known
inside. Well, the executive producer
was
a woman. The senior producer was a woman. I was general editor, and most of the staff were women.
And so the show was nicknamed Leave It to Beaver?
The men in the building called Overnight, the first network news program run by women, Leave It to Beaver.
Was there resentment that there were all these women running the show?
You know, I think probably among the men who didn't work on it, there was. But for the people who worked on the show, just before Overnight went off the air, NBC had commissioned a study to find out why Overnight, which had the worst hours in the building, also had the lowest absentee rate of any show at the network. And I mean, I don't know what they would have found out because the show was canceled during the study. But my guess is what they would have found out, what was the reason, was very simple. Women, having not been exposed or had a chance at direct power, didn't really know the rules of the bad rules of the misuse of power. And they tended to treat employees as more than just the carcass you haul to work. They treated them as whole human beings. I will never forget a meeting where we were having a production meeting, and a woman walked in, and she had tears in her eyes. I don't remember exactly what it was. I think the man she was living with had left her. And someone hugged her, and someone made her a cup of tea, and then the meeting went on. And I can't imagine that happening in a male-dominated meeting. You know, we are told that, well, you must denigrate your personal life. You must lower it. And you must, you know, put your work first, or no one will take you seriously here at the corporation. And that leads to all kinds of stress. I mean, I've worked at a large corporation long enough to see the effects of stress, of whether it's drugs or whether it's heart attacks or whether it's drinking. Are you a social drinker? No, all my drinking is work-related. and the first to get, you know, to get struck down are the bosses. And I can't understand why they can't see that an employee is an entire human being, and that if you treat the person as such, you get that back.
Have you gotten the feeling that there is still an unwritten quota for the number of women allowed in?
Oh, of course there is. I mean, there's, you know, the last statistics of now showed that in the last 10 years there's been an increase on the air of 0.3%. In the number of women, and that's the least important thing. When are we going to see a woman? I don't care about when we're going to see a woman anchoring the nightly news. When are we going to see a woman president of a news division? It's an unwritten quota in blacks, and it's an unwritten quota in other minorities, and it's an unwritten quota in women, which being 51% of the population, are not minor. And it's nothing more than a case that power is never relinquished willingly.
Because there are so few slots for women, do you find that women are competitive or supportive of one another once you get into the network?
I mean, my age women, the women who are my age, you know, in their early 40s, late 30s, seem to me to be very supportive of each other. But we also remember the women's movement. I worry about a lot of the young women coming into the business. I hate the word yuppie, but it applies. Every time I see a woman who's, you know, stitched herself into a female version of a business suit, who is also starting to wear around her neck a noose, whether it's a tied in a bow or, you know, a scarf, or they're basically nooses, the same as ties are for men. Why are we doing this? I can't believe that we're going to fall into those same traps. And that's what's frightening. I don't see that as much in the older women. Those of us that went through the 60s and the 70s and were part of the first wave.
Have you participated in any broadcasting women's caucuses
or anything like that? No, I haven't. I think that's probably, that has to do with the nature of reporters, is most of us are just not joiners. Most of us are, you know, are the sort that likes to sit on the middle of the sofa somewhere and with big eyes looking at a room full of people rather than being part of a group.
I've gotten the impression.
And that may be part of our downfall.
Oh, you mean because you're not organizing?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, something's going to have to be done, because what I was talking about earlier about power never being relinquished willingly, I really think that women in our business have gone as far as they're going to go at the good grace of those in power. And where it goes from here, it's going to have to be done in ways that perhaps don't make them very happy, unless we want to turn into them.
I've always gotten the impression that women journalists, especially probably television journalists, can't really come out and say that they're feminists, even if they are, because it will seem like a political bias that's going to affect their reporting.
Well, that's one of those things we were talking about earlier when I was saying that, you know, ballots can get way out of hand. I am a feminist, flat out, and I don't feel any reason why I should sit here and say, on the other hand, not being a feminist is a wonderful idea. I don't think it's a wonderful idea. I think it has absolutely everything wrong with it that racism has wrong with it. I mean, to say you're a feminist means you believe in equality of the sexes, period.
And you've never gotten any flack for saying that from your executives.
Well, I'm not working at the moment.
You wrote in your book that you're always asked, do we use sex in our work? Do we use our sex in our work? And you say no and yes. What's the yes?
Well, the yes is really has more to do with it uses itself or it gets used. I remember the years where I would be the only woman at a news conference, and it did not matter. You didn't have to wiggle your hips or anything. The fact that you were the only woman there meant you would get called on. Now, was I using my sex? No, they were. So in that sense, yeah. I like to think that I don't use my sex, but it's very hard. On the other hand, at least in Washington, I find Washington to be one of the least sexist places in the world for a reporter, and most people are surprised by that. Whoops, I bumped the mic. But the truth is, for a professional politician, they don't see whether it's a man or a woman. They see the NBC on the side of that camera. I could be a troll.
It always seems, though, it's such a kind of tight-knit men's network in Washington, in the House and in the Senate.
That's true. It is. I'm certain that, you know, they prefer, I'm not certain, but I'm certain there are many of them who prefer talking to each other than they do talking to us girls. But none of them is fool enough to not talk to me if I am standing there with that network camera.
My guest is journalist Linda Ellerbe, who's also the author of the new book, And So It Goes, Adventures in Television. And she, by the way, this morning officially left NBC. In 1978, you threw your television out your window. What prompted that?
Well, that was actually a very simple story. I was trying to have an argument with my husband, a sensible argument, and he was watching Sonny and Cher. You can't have a sensible argument with someone who's watching Sonny and Cher. And he went downstairs to get a Dr. Pepper, I think, as I remember. And I sat there and I looked at the television and I thought, well, you pay my way and I really like you, except you've also caused me a lot of problems. And I don't know what got into me. I went over and I unplugged it and I raised the window and I walked to the window and I threw it as far as I could throw it. And the next day I felt uncomfortable with what I had done, so I went out to the backyard and retrieved it, and it had a big crack right across the screen. But it still worked. And that was the first time I discovered that you can't kill them. Television is forever. At least televisions are forever. The most interesting thing on the subject of television that I have heard lately was just recently NBC gave 20,000 hours of television programming to the Library of Congress. And Daniel Burstyn, accepting on behalf of the Library of Congress, thanked NBC and said, yes, it would be invaluable to future generations who wanted to find out what we thought was real.
That's really terrific. So do you take it out on TV, though, when you're feeling angry at someone?
No, I haven't thrown a TV. I haven't thrown a TV out the window since then, although I did find, I live in Greenwich Village in New York City, and people put things out on the street to be carted off. And one day a few years ago, I found an old RCA television with two bullet holes in the screen and no insides. So I immediately took that one inside rather than throwing it. I brought that one in the house and put it in the living room immediately. Every living room has to have a television.
Do you marvel at people who are in broadcasting now and knew from the moment that they were old enough to, like, twiddle a dial knew that they wanted to be in radio or TV.
Yeah, I mean, that worries me. What worries me is why they want to. I mean, there are many in there who are in there for all the good reasons, but you turn on the Miss America pageant and they interview the 10 women, and a good 5 or 6 of them will say that their life's ambition is to be an anchor woman. And you know, this is nothing, I'm not saying anything against beauty. My objection to Twinkies is when beauty is all you are. Phyllis George is the best example of this case that I know, and it's nothing against Phyllis. She's a nice lady. She's a very nice lady. But it was CBS News that made the decision to hire Phyllis and call her a journalist because, in their reasoning, the audience would be too dumb to know the difference. They were wrong. Thank God they were wrong.
Before your career began in earnest, you spent some time living in Alaska, and you lived collectively there. What was the kind of life you were striving for? What were some of the ideals?
Perfection. There's nothing much, just perfection. This was the late 60s and the early 70s, and we had this idea that if 15 people could live together in peace and harmony, then the whole world could live together in peace and harmony. And the only problem we had was that 15 people couldn't live together in peace and harmony, and we ended up always with, there were some people who would sit around on the sofa at night and say, oh, wow, and far out. And others would be out there on the ice digging holes to haul water up. And as one who continually found herself lying on the ice digging holes, I finally said, wait a minute, this isn't for me. But it was a good time, and it was an interesting time. I learned a number of things. I learned how to kill and dress a deer. I learned that I didn't want to do that. I learned 92 ways how to eat brown rice, and I hope never to swallow brown rice again as long as I live. I also learned a good deal of valuable lessons about living with people and sharing and community in a broader sense than family and yet smaller than a city.
Values now, that you feel you still take with
absolutely.
You? Absolutely. When you came back to the mainland after that and started applying to for press positions, did you feel like you had to cover up your past and not let on that you'd had these culturally radical experiences?
I probably should have, but I didn't. I have, you know, every so often someone will say to me, but if you just lie a little bit about your past or about your opinions, oh, things would be so easy for you. And usually it's said to me at a time when it's, you know, I sort of look at them blankly and say, but why? And they have to explain to me why it's been a disadvantage for me to just say what I've done and what I've been. No, I mean I can't see hiding that. Why should I hide that? Actually, I'm rather proud of that. I'm proud that I have a daughter who marches. I talk to enough young people these days who have no interest outside their own small circle.
It must have been hard for you getting your career established with 2 kids.
Yeah, well, it is. I mean, it's getting it established and keeping it going. But please remember, it's also hard on the 2 kids. And if I end up having any regret at all, it will be not for what it cost my career, but for what it cost my children.
Can you tell a story of how you switched from print to broadcast?
I knew you were going to ask that.
Do you mind?
I don't mind, no. I worry when I tell this story that it begins to sound pat because everyone asks me to tell this story. But it's, I was working for the Associated Press in Dallas in 1972, and they gave us word processors. And I was as low-tech then as I am now. In fact, if this book is a success, and apparently it is only because I didn't try to write it on a word processor. But there I was in 72, and late one night after I'd written a story, I think about city council, I wrote a long, chatty letter to a friend, and in the letter I maligned the Dallas newspapers and the Dallas City Council and Dallas and the Vietnam War and a man I was dating, and I finished off by saying that Renee Peterson, a friend of mine, was leaving the AP, and when she left, I would be the only woman among 16 writers, and if the bureau chief wanted to get rid of his discriminatory guilt, he would hire a half-black Chicano lesbian who could handle the AP style book. And I mean, I wasn't so stupid as to let this get on the wire. No, I was stupid enough to let it get on hold in the computer. The following morning was an Apollo shot, and something keyed the letter, and it went over the AP wire, and I was fired immediately, and rightfully so. They were quite right to fire me. Their mistake was hiring me, which I believe is how they still can look at it over the AP. And I was devastated. I had a 2-year-old, a 3-year-old, and I was then, as I am now, their sole support. And I thought, I've not only have I messed myself up with the AP, I've messed myself up with anybody in the business who would hire me because of this stupid, stupid era. And the reverse happened. I got calls from one of the newspapers I'd maligned and a radio station and UPI and the news director of KHOU in Houston. And he said, "Have you ever thought about television?" And I told him almost never, that I had just come from Alaska where they really had no television and I had no television. All I knew about those people was they got in your way on the street and they were forever asking someone how he feels about something. And he said, "Well, here's what we pay." And it was about twice what I had been making at the AP. And I said, "Well, I think I could learn television." And just before we got off the phone, he said, "Oh, by the way, are you 3 feet tall and have warts, big ones, or anything like that?" And I said, no, I had them all burned off yesterday. I don't know if I'm the only woman ever hired into television news over the telephone, but I suspect it doesn't happen very often these days.
I'm sure it doesn't. What was your first reaction to yourself when you saw yourself on TV for the first time?
Oh, I was horrified. It's the same reaction that everyone has the first time you hear your voice on a tape recorder, only magnified. There you are at one point, you're also listening to your voice, and there is your picture up there moving and in color. Or in my case, I was as stiff as a board. It was probably practiced for later when Saturday Night Live used to do satire on me about how my face or neck or expression never changed when I did the news. But, you know, it's embarrassing. I mean, to this day, I really don't watch what I do on television. I'll watch the pieces I do. But this morning, in fact, is probably the first time that I've sat down and replayed the Today Show and watched. And that was only because it was my last broadcast on NBC News. And it was a hard one for me to get through, frankly. And toward the end, about the point where I was getting ready to say, "And so it goes," I felt my voice going. And I thought, well, that's it, Ellerbe. Here you are after all these years, you're going to dry up on the air and a tear is going to roll down your cheek. And I really got scared. And I made it through. And I wanted to replay the tape and see if I could see that. And when I replayed the tape, no, I couldn't see that at all. It was one of those things where I was playing the drum from the inside my head. And it was what I was seeing going out. And it was not something you could see going in.
Did that scare you, though, the thought that maybe on your goodbye to the network and to your viewers from NBC that a tear would that have been really humiliating to you?
It probably shouldn't have been. I mean, it probably shouldn't have been at all. But, you know, you tell yourself what a tough cookie you are.
Right.
And I ought to know better. If I learned anything on Overnight, it's that the audience will accept you being a human being more rapidly than will accept anything else. But for some reason, I was determined that I felt my words, because they were, I get accused of being acerbic or a skeptic, and what I was saying there were basically very sentimental words about the people at NBC News. Here I was going all mushy, and I thought, well, the words are strong enough. You know, I don't need to go at the same time, and I didn't want to do that.
So you usually don't watch yourself when you're on TV?
No. I think there were probably some people at NBC who were far more worried about what I would say this morning. In another vein. It's curious because nobody sees my copy before I go on the air at TGIF.
Really? I'm surprised to hear that.
And they don't see TGIF before it goes on
the
air.
Oh, I thought everything was just so highly edited.
I know. I'm the producer and editor and writer for that. And yesterday, when it was known that I was leaving, when I said, "No, thank you, I'm leaving," and I said, I will do TGIF for free tomorrow because my contract was up. And I didn't want to leave Steve Friedman, who was executive producer of the Today Show and a good man, with a hole in his show, nor did I want to leave the air just disappearing without saying goodbye. And so I said, "I'll do it for free." And they came back and said, "No, we'll pay you." And I said, "All right." so you won't worry. I will be happy to show you my copy. And they said, it's not necessary.
That's awfully nice. I mean, I have to say I'm surprised because I always thought that one of the great fears at any broadcasting outlet is that on somebody's last day, they're going to let loose with vitriolic phrases about management or whatever. And that's why a lot of people are fired before their last show.
Roger Grimsby.
I mean, fired like they're never allowed on the air after the fire.
That's right. Well, I think that showed a lot of class on the part of NBC, frankly. And it's kind of class you're going to return.
You started to work at NBC in 1975 after working at the CBS affiliate in New York. Mm-hmm. Did you have an initiation into the network where other reporters and the anchors and the executives felt you out before they'd really let you do
anything?
Just
the sort of thing that I talked about earlier where you have to write gray jello for a long time until they're certain that you know how to write gray jello, and then they'll allow you to write something else. But other than that, no. The other reporters and the other producers were all very good. But best of all were the cameramen and camerawomen, the sound recordist, and the film editors and videotape editors. Those are the people who teach you television. Management allows you to learn it.
So you found the camera operators and crews really, really helpful.
Not just really helpful. That's who taught me everything that I know. If I'm any good as a producer, and I'm a better producer than I am on the air, it's because of those people.
When the first time you were on the air with David Brinkley was also the first time you met him, basically?
Yes.
That story really surprised me.
We both worked in Washington, and his office was six doors down the hall from mine. But he's a shy man, and I did not know this at the time. And I thought he was stuck up, because every time I passed him in the hall, I didn't introduce myself because he looked as if he already knew enough people. And then I was asked to anchor this program, Campaign and the Candidates, with him. I thought, well, now we'll meet, because when we write the show together, we'll have to meet. And we didn't, because he wrote the show in his office with the door shut, so that we did not meet until just a few minutes before air, when we got on the set. And we didn't really meet then, because we were both embarrassed to admit we hadn't met. So we just sat down, and we were just before going on air, and I turned around to him, and I said, David, Mr. Brinkley, sir, I know you've done this forever, but I'm brand new at it, and I'm very scared. I'm frightened. And he looked at me as if he just noticed I were there, and he said, I don't know why you'd be frightened. All they can do is fire you. Good evening. And we were on the air. And I got it through the show, and about 3 weeks later, when no one had fired me, I realized just how right he was. And it's something I've held on to all these years. He's right. All they can do is fire me. They can't eat me. They can't put me in reporter jail. They can't take away whatever that is that's me. All they can do is fire me.
To some people, though, that's a lot because you get
involved
with your
work. It is a lot. As someone who's raising two kids, it is a lot. But it's not everything. It's really not. And once you understand that and know that, then it gives you a freedom to do things the way you think they ought to be done and not the way you think will please someone.
I'd imagine that people at the network level are very protective of their jobs because they know that everybody on the local affiliate level wants to get to the network. What are some of the weird things people will do to try to protect themselves against the competition?
Almost anything, I would assume. Probably anything that they do is no more weird than you find in corporate America anywhere. You're going to find backbiting, and you're going to find people using sex and people just flat out being mean and nasty. But I don't think a network is any different than General Motors in that. We just happen to have one of those high-profile businesses. For example, there are about, I think, 1,300 full-time employees of NBC News in the whole world. And every year, there are about 40,000 applications for those 1,300 jobs. The division doesn't work out.
You mentioned in your book that Chris Wallace got the big scoop of the 1980 Republican convention because he found out who Reagan's running mate was going to be 40 seconds before the other network news shows did.
That's because our coverage of conventions has changed radically over the years, as conventions have changed.
Well, do you think that's a mistake, though, this emphasis on scooping to the degree that, you know, if you get it 10 seconds before the other network
does,
that it really matters?
I just think it's kind of silly.
Mm-hmm.
To we are not living in Chicago in the 20s. This is not City News Service, and this is not Front Page, the movie. I don't think it matters that much who gets a 40-second scoop on who's going to be the vice president. There was a time when a floor reporter at a convention needed to be someone who could put a little historical spin on what was going on, someone who had a well-grounded background, don't you like that, in politics. These days, actually, what you really need is a pair of track shoes to cover a convention. And that's nothing against the reporters. The fact is that television and the political system have joined in this unholy marriage that has pretty much made conventions as useless as female equipment on a bull. The primary system and the rise of television have combined to just basically do away with the purpose of conventions. And they're really nothing more now than orchestrated passion plays for television.
You've anchored two shows that have been ended by the network, Weekend and Overnight. What are the ways that executives break the news to you that the show is going to be over?
Weekend, that was an extraordinary one. Lloyd Dobbins and I were in Palm Springs to interview President Ford, or former President Ford at the time, and our plane got there late, and we went to the hotel, and we went to the bar, because the restaurant wasn't open. Actually, we'd have probably gone to the bar anyway. And we got a phone call in the bar, and it was an NBC vice president. And he said that it had occurred to him that we didn't know what had happened, and what had happened was that Weekend had been canceled, and the president of NBC News had released this information to the press and then had gotten on a plane to China without telling us. And he thought that was not the right way to handle it. And he was on vacation in Beverly Hills, and he had stopped at the first phone he could come across to call us, which he wanted to apologize for why it sounded so strange in the background. But he was calling from the men's room of a Beverly Hills restaurant, and it seemed perfectly appropriate to us. On Overnight, I found out because Reuven Frank called me at home in the morning, and he said, "Can you come in early?" I usually went in about 2:30 or 3 in the afternoon. And he said, "Can you come in early? And I want to talk with you." And I've known Reuven for many years, and I said, "Reuven, I hate surprises. What is this? Is this good news or bad news?" And he said, "I have some very bad news." And I said, "Please tell me now. You know, I don't want to wait." And he said, "Overnight's been canceled." So I said, "Okay, you can give me the rest of the bad news when I get there."
What was your reaction to that?
I was very unhappy, very unhappy. I cried, and I got over my crying, and then I went to work.
That's always tough because you don't want anyone That's to right. know how upset you are. So you have to wash your face a lot and cover it up. Do you watch a lot of TV on it?
I watch I watch the news, and other than that, I watch old movies and baseball.
When a show of yours ends, you know that whole this is a showbiz phrase that you're only as good as your last show, blah blah blah. Do you always have enough confidence to think, well, I'll have another great show?
Well, I think you have to. I mean, I try to keep Bob Weir in mind. Bob Weir's lead guitarist of the Grateful Dead. And some years ago, I was talking to him, and I brought up the subject. I said, "This is a band that survives, and it goes on and on, year after year, although it's never had a hit single." And there are a lot of people who say, "You can't play in the same key, you can't start and stop at the same time, except by accident. What keeps you going?" And he said, "Well, you can't please everybody." I think you just have to take that attitude. You know, it is only television. It's not brain surgery. There was a time right after the first edition of Summer Sunday, which was a dreadful program, that first edition at least, and there were a group of us in Washington, and we were sitting in a hotel room, and we were going back and forth arguing about live versus tape and which was best. And this went on, live tape, for a while until my son, who was 14 at the time, explained things to us, and he stood up and he said, "None of you knows what you're talking about. You don't understand anything at all. You, me, everybody here in this room, this is live." And he pointed to the box in the corner and he said, "That, Mom, that is television."
Are your children awed by television and awed by the fact you're on it?
Not at all. The only time I have ever been able to impress my son was when Amnesty International asked me to host 6 hours of their concert on MTV. And Josh sort of looked at me and said, "You on MTV? My mother on MTV? Wow, can you get me tickets?" And my daughter is not impressed at all. They are both writers. And you know, they've grown up around me being on television. And most of my friends that are not most, but many of them are on television, and the others are mostly writers too. So no, they're not, they don't find it impressive at all.
Most people find it very impressive, and I've noticed from having done just a teeny little bit of TV that if you say you're in radio, people go, "Oh, that's really nice, that's really interesting." If you say you're on television, it's like, television? Yeah. And it's as if there was these trumpet fanfares before you said that.
To the point that my daughter has on many occasions, you know, she just won't say who mom is because she doesn't want her relationship with whoever she's talking to skewed in some way. Because of that, and we've talked about that, and she says, you know, it's like the line from the movie Network. You know, "Why me, God? Because you're on television, dummy." And Vanessa understands that quite clearly, that it has little to do with me, and it has a lot to do with simply the fact I'm on television.
Have you figured out in your career so far how much to
give to you? I figured out very little in my career so far.
How much to give to your work and how much to keep for yourself?
No, I mean, you always debate that. You're always going to have that. And as I say, especially where children are concerned, you can't, you know, you always hear this, "Well, I just love it when magazines call me and say, well, we want to do stories about women who have it all, and how do you juggle home and career?" And I say, "Are you crazy? You don't juggle it. You don't balance it. When you are missing the school play because you're at work, you miss the school play. And when you're at work because you miss the school play, or when you're at the school play, you missed work." And you're constantly going back and forth on that sort of thing. And you're always going to feel guilty about that. You're never going to come into a resolution about it. And you're going to hope that both your children and your job, the people at your job, will understand and have some forgiveness, and most of all that you will.
How important is it for you to be on air? Earlier today you said that you thought in a lot of ways you were a better producer than you were an on-air person.
I would much rather not be on the air. The sad fact of my business is it pays better, and I have more control by the fact that I'm on air. I'm my own producer because I'm on air. If I were a producer, I would be producing for some jerk like me who's on the air and would have less control.
Your book jacket says that you live with your two children and a house full of other people. Who else do you live with?
Well, there are... When my editor wrote that, and I said, just don't write anything about my personal life on that jacket. Just write about my work. And he phoned back and he said, I had to write something. And so he wrote that line, and I started laughing. And I said, well, it raises more questions than it answers, but it describes it better than anything I've heard. The simple fact is that when I was coming along and I had little or nothing, there were people who were very good to me. And I have a big place, and I have extra bedrooms. And it has given me great, it makes me feel good to be able to give something back. And so usually those bedrooms are filled with students or young actors or actresses. Don't apply. It's not like that. I mean, they're friends of friends or relatives of relatives. And they're there. And that's what it is. It's, you know, they pass through.
You plan on staying in television?
I don't know. For the time being, yeah. But I've always felt, speaking of passing through, I have always felt that I was passing through this. And I'm not sure what I'm passing through it to. But I certainly don't see myself doing this 10 years from now, probably not 5 years from now.
Why not?
There are other things I want to do. And one of the things that I want to do is to have a lot of choices. I have the obligations you assume when you're raising children. You assume willingly the financial obligations. My children are at an age where I can see the end of that. And when that happens, I don't need as much money. And frankly, I intend to take some chances. I want to study animation. I have always wanted to study animation. I want to try my hand at directing. There are other things that I want to study and other chances I want to take. And I don't think television is in there, at least not being in front of a camera.
Somewhere down the road.
Yeah.
You'll give that up.
Yeah. Okay. It'll be the easiest thing to give up.
But don't you get used to all the attention? And
I don't know. I mean, you know, maybe I have. I like to think I haven't. I'm still more put off by that than I am when it's not there. I mean, right now, with the book being a bestseller and my contract dispute going on, all these people coming up to me on the street. I had lunch the other day, and the man served my meal and leaned over in my ear and said, "Stuff, NBC." And I thought, all of a sudden, I thought, I'm not alone here. And I looked around and I could see some people looking at me. And I thought, I must be very careful not to pick my nose because I thought I was alone and I'm not.
That about sums it up, I guess. Linda Ellerbee, it's been wonderful to have you here. I thank you very much for coming to talk with us today.
I had a good time.
And I wish you the best and thank you for being
thank
here.
You.
My guest has been journalist Linda Ellerbee, who became best known for being the co-anchor of Overnight and of Weekend and for her TGIF segments on the Today Show. This morning she announced that she would be leaving NBC and today was her last day with NBC. She's written a book which is now a bestseller. It's titled And So It Goes, Adventures in Television, and it's published by Putnam, and it will probably someday be made into a movie because the rights were optioned for that. Thanks again for being with us. It's 2 minutes to five, all things considered, coming up at five from National Public Radio. I'll tell you about what's happening next week on Fresh Air after we check in with Shadow Traffic.
Well, jam traffic this afternoon on the Schuylkill Expressway eastbound between the Blue Route and the Conshohocken Curve. Slow again from Montgomery to Girard, then very heavy near Spring Garden Street. There's a disabled truck blocking the right-hand lane. Westbound, you can expect a 15-minute delay between the Boulevard and City, then slow traffic again between Belmont Avenue and Gladwin. 95 northbound, very slow from Penn's Landing up to the Ben Franklin Bridge. Jam traffic into New Jersey over the Whitman Bridge down on the 42 to Route 55. That's Shadow Traffic, and I'm John Butterworth on 91 FM, WHYY.
That Shadow Traffic Report was funded by the Philadelphia Business Journal. This Sunday afternoon at 6, on the Best of Fresh Air, we'll hear from poet, playwright, and essayist Amiri Baraka. And coming up next week on Fresh Air, we'll feature Marian McPartland's Piano Jazz on Monday. It's the last edition, and her guest will be Herman Foster. At 3 o'clock, Danny Miller will speak with Seymour Wishman, author of Anatomy of a Jury, The System on Trial. Tuesday afternoon at 4 o'clock, Amy Sallet will speak with performance artist, monologist Spalding Gray, who has a new book of some of his monologues. And this Wednesday at 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by New York Times sports writer Ira Burkow, who has written a new biography of Red Smith. This Thursday afternoon on Fresh Air at 4 o'clock, we'll hear from soul singer Solomon Burke, so I hope you can be listening. That about does it for today's show. Paul Kerber was our engineer. Thanks to our interns, Tom Cellini and Abby Klebanoff. Amy Sallet is the associate producer of the show. Danny Miller and I are the producers. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. I hope you have a terrific weekend. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where listeners supported public radio in the Delaware Valley.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nina Totenberg.
This is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
The association with criminals hurts me greatly. After 30 years of professional police work, I have never associated with criminals in a wrongful way, and I still have not.
In Great Britain, a parliamentary furor over an investigator. Was he set up or mobbed up?
Also tonight, in All Things Considered, the World Court rules against the U.S. in favor of Nicaragua.
In Nicaragua, the Sandinista government cracks down on opponents.
How to talk back to the media.
The Supreme Court rules that airlines are not subject to laws protecting the handicapped.
And from the Folklife Festival on the Malt here in Washington, the Memphis blues music of Jesse May Hemphill. That and more tonight in All Things Considered. First, we have this news.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. The World Court ruled today that the United States violated international law by supporting Nicaragua's Contra rebels. The court in The Hague said the U.S. should halt all anti-Sandinista military activities.